Manon, willst du vielleicht das noch etwas überzulassen, damit du was dir dann etwas damit machst? Wenn du stehst, was für die Idee du, oder wenn du etwas sagen willst, dann stehst du. So, nur weil du etwas gehabt hast, dann stehst du. Om Agnitana Jaya. Jana Jana Salakaya Chaksis Miratan Jaina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namah. Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam Zavadikare. Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Kodakti Sarpatati. Manisha Kapa Subhya Chak Kusam Bhairava Sarpati Tam Pabani Dho. Vaisha Bhairava Namah. Last verse we read was that the embodied living being, this is text 13, controls his nature and mentally renounces all actions. He acts, but he mentally renounces the fact that he is doing the action and therefore he should get the result. So such a person, controlling his nature, conditioned nature, and mentally renounces all activities, he resides happily in the city of nine gates, the material body, neither working nor causing work to be done. So, we read from Prabhupada's purport about changing one's deliberations. So the actions are there to please Krishna, but the method of acting, the mode of acting is to please Krishna, not to please oneself. So then the next two verses are quite interesting. Nakartritvam nakamani lokasya sridjati prabhu nakama phala samyogam svabhavas tu pravartate. The embodied spirit, the soul, master of the city of the body, because we just heard of him living in the city of the body, he does not create activities. So he's not the one creating the activities that he's performing. He, meaning the soul, is not creating the activities that he, meaning the body, is performing. Nor does he induce people to act. Nor does he create the fruits of action. All this is enacted by the modes of material nature. So from this, we understand that he's not the one, the soul isn't doing anything. We'll read the purport here, but I wanted to read the next verse. So he's not creating his activities, nor is he inducing people to act. He's living in the body, but very, actually quite aloof from the life of the body. Nor does the Supreme Lord assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. So the person is acting, but he's not the one acting. But yet he's getting the reactions for what he does. Isn't that mysterious? Nor does the Supreme Lord assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. So Krishna, even though he's the ultimate sarva karanam karanam, he's the cause of all causes, he doesn't get the reactions. He doesn't assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance which covers their real knowledge. So it is actually due to ignorance, the soul's ignorance, not exactly the soul's ignorance, but his, because the soul is a soul, he can't actually, on one level, be covered by ignorance. He's eternally what he is, but he forgets that. He forgets his real self, his real identity, and adopts a false ego, a false sense of self by the influence of Maya. And therefore, even though he is not acting, And even though Maya is under the control of the Supreme Lord, the three modes of material nature are under the control of the Supreme Lord, and Krishna through the modes of material nature is actually acting, not the soul, yet because of the ignorance of the soul, he gets the reaction for what he does. And that ignorance is that attempt to enjoy on the material level, even though he's not capable of enjoying because he's of a different substance completely. But it's that false ego. It is Maya in that sense, the illusory energy of Krishna that takes two opposing substances, so to speak. The soul, which is eternal, made out of the spirit, so that is Chaitragya Kyatatapara, superior energy, and it makes it, it bewilders the living entity due to the living entity's desire to enjoy the material world. He bewilders the living entity, he sort of harnesses the living entity to the material energy, and therefore the living entity experiences all the suffering as if he is suffering, as if he's experiencing, as if he's doing everything, that he's making everyone act, that he's speaking to someone, but actually he's completely aloof, and all this is going on by the modes of material nature. So it is quite an entangled, mysterious situation. And the cause of this mysterious situation, in one sense you could say, is the Supreme Lord, because he's the cause of all causes. And from another point of view, the cause of this mysterious situation is the modes of material nature, because, or Maya, because they're doing everything. And from another point of view, the cause is the living entity himself, the soul, because it's his desires that are turning everything upside down. So here's Prabhupada's purport. So who's the cause of everything? Ultimately, it's Krishna. But in another sense, is the soul, who's causing it due to our desiring, and desiring is the heart of our situation. This is explained in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that the living entity is situated on his desire, just like the reflection of the tree is situated on water. So we are situated in the material world based on our desires, and desiring is the essence of our bondage, and it's also the essence of our freedom. And this is within our free will. We may not be able to do everything by our own power, we can't. But desiring is so much where our freedom lies. And from proper desires comes birth, proper activities, and Krishna's mercy ultimately. So it's so important to get the desires proper. So here's the 14 again, and then we'll read Prabhupada's purport, and then read 15 and Prabhupada's purport. The embodied spirit, master of the city of his body, does not create activities, nor does he induce people to act, nor does he create the fruits of action. So in other words, he's quite inactive in one sense. Well, he's in a material body. So all this is enacted by the modes of material nature. So the material energy, or Krishna's Maya Shakti, is creating activities. And he's inducing people to act, and he's creating the fruits of action, or the modes of material nature. All this is enacted by the modes of material nature. And of course, as we know, that the modes of material nature are created by Krishna, and yet Krishna is not getting the reactions for it, because he's just reciprocating. The modes of material nature are reciprocating with the desires of the living entity. So here's what reading from Prabhupada's purport, maybe the beginning in the second sentence. First sentence is a long sentence. Third sentence, rather. The temporary body or material dwelling place which he obtains is the cause of varieties of activities and their resultant reactions. Living in such a conditioned atmosphere, one suffers the results of the activities of the body by identifying himself in ignorance with the body. It is ignorance acquired from time immemorial that is the cause of bodily suffering and distress. As soon as the living entity becomes aloof from the activities of the body, he becomes free from the reactions as well. As long as he is in the city of the body, he appears to be the master of it, but actually he's neither its proprietor nor controller of its actions and reactions. He's simply in the midst of the material ocean, struggling for existence. The waves of the ocean are tossing him, and he has no control over them. His best solution is to get out of the water by transcendental Krishna consciousness. That alone will save him from all turmoil. It's quite astounding. Here we are, thinking that we know what's going on, and if we're going to accept what Krishna says and what Prabhupada says, we're in an ocean just simply being tossed around by the waves. Has anyone ever been in a situation that they were close to drowning in the water? Oh, so many people. Well, what did it feel like?
Well, I felt like I was going to die.
What, you were in the water?
Yeah, and underwater, like when scuba diving, sort of the waves pulled me down 200 meters.
200 meters?
Yeah, wow. Nitrogen sort of poisoning, you just don't know where you are, don't know where it's up or down. It's pretty scary.
Helpless, yes.
Yeah.
That's the point. It's a feeling of helplessness. And actually, the illusion is that we're in control of everything. But it's clear we're not in control. Are we in control of our hearts beating? Are you in control of your... Are you in control of your hearts beating? Admit it. Okay. How about the breathing even? We've been going through this list almost every class, all the things we're not... The lymphatic system. Just everything. The growing of our nails. It just happens. The blinking of our eyes. The
growing of hair.
The smiling. Oop, don't smile. You're smiling. Don't smile. Don't smile. Be in control. I'm not smiling anymore. Laughing is included in smiling. Stop that. Alex. And we're being tossed by the waves of the material energy. This way and that way. And no control over them. If we think we're not in control, it's terrifying. What was your experience like in the water?
I just became shoulder and surfing.
Oh. Mm. Dangerous.
I just couldn't. Wiped out. I collected the weight coming over on my shoulder doing the bottom 10 and pushed my shoulder right up. And couldn't get up, back up. Came to the surface, but I couldn't get up onto my board. I couldn't do anything with that side of my body. Got washed in on the rocks.
Frightening?
Mm. Yeah.
Frightening because?
Didn't want to die.
Yeah. And it wasn't in your control. Whether you were or not, what was going to happen. This point of being in control, that feeling of being in control is very essential for our sanity, but it's actually illusion. Well, Dave, What was your experience like?
I collapsed in the water.
In the water?
In the water. Almost. I was 4 feet height at the time, but on the swimming pool, which is 6 feet. But I just look on the stair. I was underwater. Almost like.
You can still remember it, even.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like you're seeing it while you're.
And then I climbed.
Who else? Someone else raised their hand. Who else? Almost. Ananda. Yeah.
I was learning how to swim. And then I had a bet with Lord to catch the ball in the deep water. The ball was in the water is very deep. So I started swimming and I had just learned at that time. And then I lost my, like, I couldn't breathe because I have already swimmed more meters and the ball was going away and away. And then I started drowning. And I screamed, help, help, and I drank a lot of water.
the whole ocean. And then it was. And then what happened? Did you drown?
And then Krishna sent the card. Like the lifesaver guy in the swimming pool.
How old are you?
Oh, I was in 8th standard, so probably 13 years old.
Yeah.
14 years old. But after that, I don't swim.
Yeah. That's what sort of growing up is. It's learning how to swim in the material energy and to do your best. What happened to you?
I was in primary school in year 2. And then the teacher comes to me and he asks me, do you know how to swim in the deep? And I just lied to him. And he threw me inside.
Just to see if you were telling the truth or not. It's very interesting teaching methodology, isn't it?
Yeah, I just learned like that.
Did you learn how to swim or how to drown?
No, then I struggled to come back up. And,
and you did it. Were you afraid? Yeah. So, in the material world, the material energy, it is like being in the ocean, and the waves of the ocean toss us, and we have no control over them. And the best solution is to get out of the water by transcendental Krishna consciousness, get out of the material energy. That alone will save him from all turmoil. So that's what we want, to be placed within the hand of Krishna. So, text 15. Nor does the Supreme Lord assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance which covers their real knowledge. Here's from Prabhupada's purport reading about. Just a little bit down. A living entity is, by superior nature, full of knowledge. Nevertheless, he is prone to be influenced by ignorance due to his limited power. The Lord is omnipotent, but the living entity is not. The Lord is vibhu, or omniscient, but the living entity is anu, or atomic. Because he is a living soul, he has the capacity to desire by his free will. He has the capacity to desire by his free will. Such desire is fulfilled only by the omnipotent Lord. And so, when the living entity is bewildered in his desires, the Lord allows him to fulfill those desires. But the Lord is never responsible for the actions and reactions of the particular situation which may be desired. Being in a bewildered condition, therefore, the embodied soul identifies himself with the circumstantial material body and becomes subjected to the temporary miseries and happiness of life. And what's the cause of experiencing the temporary miseries and happinesses of life? It's identification with the circumstantial material body and then Krishna giving us our desires and the reaction to what we do allows us to experience our desires and their reactions. And the Lord is the and He stays with us continuously in these situations. He's the lifeguard. The Lord is the constant companion of the living entity as Paramatma, or the Supersoul, and therefore He can understand the desires of the individual soul, as one can smell the flavor of a flower by being near it. Desire is a subtle form of conditioning for the living entity. The Lord fulfills His desires, the living entity's desires, as He, the living entity, deserves. Man proposes and God disposes. The living entity is not, therefore, omnipotent in fulfilling His desires. The Lord, however, can fulfill all desires, and the Lord, being neutral to everyone, does not interfere with the desires of the minute independent living entities. However, when one desires Krishna, so now the topic changes slightly. This is also explained later in the ninth chapter. Because up to this point, Krishna and Prabhupada are explaining that the living entity is in the ocean and experiencing things due to his bewilderment, but also due to Krishna's sanction. And Krishna is simply giving him his desires according to what he deserves. And Krishna is neutral in this regard. So when something bad happens to people in this world, it's not God who's making bad things happen any more than it's the judge that's applying the law and sentencing someone who has stolen to go to jail. It's not the judge who's doing it. And one level you can say the judge is doing it because he's applying the law. Another level you can say the law is doing it. But the real level that we should think on is that the person himself is causing himself to be in the to be put in prison because of his inappropriate activities, and the law is just being applied to him. The law is neutral, and the lawgiver is just sanctioning things. But all this changes for a devotee. So that's what Prabhupada is going to explain now. When one desires Krishna, the Lord takes special care and encourages one to desire in such a way that one can attain to Him and be eternally happy. And there are so many Vedic quotations saying how Krishna is neutral in His dealings. It's not like when you see someone who's wealthy and that means that God is pleased with him, and you see someone who is poor and it means that God is displeased with him. Or you see someone who's crippled and God is angry at him. And if you see someone who is beautiful and healthy, that God is really just blessing him. It's not like that. This is all just simply the unfolding of the law that is neutral according to one's pious or impious activities. This principle is for the people in general. But when one becomes a devotee, that means becomes inclined to serve Krishna or desiring to serve Krishna, then maya tatesya chapyaham. The beginning of that verse from the ninth chapter is samoham sarvabhuteshu name dveshostinapya. That I'm equal to everyone. Krishna says samoham sarvabhuteshu name dvesho. I'm not inimical to anyone, or no one is specifically dear to me. This is from the position of the Supersoul. Ye bhajanti tumam bhaktiya, but, two means but, ye bhajanti, but one who worships me, ye bhajanti tumam bhaktiya, and becomes my devotee, maya tatesya chapyam. I live especially in that person, and that person lives especially in me. I have a special relationship with that person, and I don't act neutrally to him anymore. So, what Prabhupada says here is that he encourages him when one desires Krishna, when one becomes a devotee, he encourages, he takes special care and encourages one to desire in such a way that he can attain to him and be eternally happy. So the desiring again is central here. It's central that Krishna encourages us to increase our desires, and when you see in that way, and you can interpret your experiences in that way, that this is Krishna giving me in the form of sometimes like this, or sometimes a sweet, or sometimes in other ways, but he's encouraging us to increase our desires to come to him. He's teaching. And it describes in some of the Goswami's prayers that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he's begging the living entities to come to him, to get out of this illusion that we can be happy and in the material world and that we're in control. And the attempt is always to get more and more control in the material world. That's why people are so obsessed with financial success, because that with money you can control, and when you can control, you can enjoy and fight off the things that are negative, that will get in the way of your enjoyment. Itsa, dvesa, samudena. That's why money is so much the focus of people's activities, because it is, money means Lakshmi. Lakshmi means Shakti. Shakti means power. So with power, money means power, then you can control. And if you can control, you can enjoy. And if you can't control, you can't enjoy, because then things get forced upon you. So the attempt is always to gain more power in the material world for materialists. And for a devotee, the attempt is just the opposite. It's to gain more affection for Krishna, service to Krishna, dependence on Krishna, placing oneself under Krishna's protection. Because a devotee means he trusts Krishna's bhaktivatsalya nature. Bhaktivatsalya means what? Huh? Well, one who takes care of his devotees. This is Krishna's most endearing characteristic, that he's the lover of his devotees. And his reciprocation is far more than the devotees can ever give him. Like that story of Sudama Brahmana, how Sudama Brahmana was so poor, and he was a school friend of Krishna's, and then when he grew up he was very so poor, and there was Krishna living nearby in Dwarka as powerfully rich opulent king. So his wife said, "Why don't you go, and not that we're greedy, but we need enough to live, why don't you go to ask your friend, you went to school with him, you were so close, go and ask him if we could have something." So Sudama Brahmana wasn't particularly interested in asking for anything on the material level, but he was so happy to go and see Krishna. So he was thinking about Krishna and walked from his home to Dwarka, Krishna. And the culture was such that because he was a Brahmana, he was just allowed to walk into the palaces. The guards didn't keep him out. No security passes, no security codes, no, just was able to walk in. And when Krishna saw him, he immediately embraced him, remembering him as his old friend. And before Sudama had left, he realized, "I can't go to see my old friend Krishna without bringing some gift, but he had a problem, that there was actually, he was so poor that he had nothing in his house that he could give Krishna as a gift. So he went to his neighbors and begged some very, very simple food to bring to Krishna, some chipped rice, some flattened rice. Have you ever eaten flattened rice? With yogurt? With milk? No, he hasn't eaten any. There's nothing we can do about this. Except feed this poor boy some flat rice sometime. So he took some of this flat dried rice and he wrapped it in the corner of his cloth. He begged some from the neighbors and then he went to see Krishna. And then some very sweet exchanges are described in the Bhagavatam in chapters 80 and 81 of this 10th canto. And then at some point Krishna said, you must have brought me some food. And there Krishna was in his opulent palace. And the Brahmin, Siddhama, was so embarrassed because all he had was this very low-grade flat rice. But Krishna insisted, what did you bring me? What did you bring me? And Siddhama brought it out and Krishna grabbed it forcibly and took a bite of it. And Rukmini Devi, the goddess of fortune, stopped him from taking any more. And then they had some experiences and they talked, and then the next day Siddhama went home. And he didn't ask anything from Krishna at all to alleviate his poverty. And then when he got home, when he neared his house, and Krishna didn't mention anything either. So when he neared his house, he saw it. As he walked home, he saw everything had changed and it was and all opulences had been awarded to him. So the question is asked by the acharyas, why didn't Krishna say, why Sudama didn't say anything to him, but why didn't Krishna, who knew, he could see the condition of poor Sudama Brahmana, why didn't he say anything, I will give you all this opulence? And the answer is given by the acharyas that Krishna was embarrassed. Because when someone gives you a gift, you should reciprocate equally with that person on an equal level. And Krishna felt embarrassed because Sudama was so poor that he had to beg something beyond his own possession to give to Krishna. And Krishna was thinking, he's given me something more than what he has. And look at my situation. Everything is mine in existence. So there's nothing more than what I have. So I can't reciprocate with him equally. So he was very embarrassed and he only gave him like unlimited opulences. But he was very embarrassed about it. So he didn't say anything. So sorry to explain that. So this is what we're dealing with. Who we're dealing with. If we trust that Krishna, he's what's he called, Bhava Grahi Janardana, he sees the essence of the mood of the devotee, that he reciprocates with that Atma Pajanta Vadanyata, that he gives himself to his devotee, that we used to hear when we first started chanting, that if you take one step to Krishna, then what happens?
He takes 1,000 steps towards you.
What number did you hear? 1,000 also. 10,000, 100.
I heard million before.
A million. It depends who you're telling you. But yes. Because anyway, it doesn't make any difference how many it takes, because with 3 steps he covered the whole universe. So, as Lord Vamandev, so his steps are all unlimited anyway. So if we actually have that much trust of Krishna, then if we have that kind of faith, and we place ourselves in Krishna's care and desire to please him and desire to serve him, then what will be fearful for us in this world? And on the other hand, if we don't trust Krishna, and who do we usually trust if we don't trust Krishna?
Our mind.
Yeah, ourselves, our mind, our own power. Then, well, what will it take for us to feel secure then in this world? First of all, we know our minds, how many times have our minds tricked us and told us one thing, only to later reveal that it wasn't true at all, what we've been told, or we're enamored by something and it turns out to be something completely different. The mind says, yes, you buy it, you need it. You need it immediately, buy it. When most, so much of the sales of things, it's all impulse buying. So much of it is impulse buying. You go to some supermarket, you have one thing in your mind and you end up coming back with 10 things. And people buy houses on impulse. Things like that. And you know, their whole lives can be cars. I had a friend who did that. He was visiting when I was in the university. He was visiting and he went out for a walk. He was visiting from New York and he came back with a car. It's true. Or some paintings sometimes. But it's impulse, yeah. That's you have to, a good salesman will get the impulses going. And that's the advertising, is just, it's to trick the mind, the whole. That's where the people who are, most of the people who graduate in psychology in the university, they go into advertising. So that, what is advertising? It's the way to manipulate the mind so that when you look at the advertisement, you want it regardless of whether you actually want it or not, or need it or not. It's to circumvent your need and just go right to the mind and get the mind to want something, regardless of whether you need it or not. I mean, that's what advertising is. So who are we going to trust? So you know, maybe we have our doubts. You know, that will Krishna really protect me? But we don't have any doubts about whether the mind will protect us or not. It won't. I mean, if we're, and we don't have any doubts of whether we have an ability to protect ourselves fully or not. Prabhupada says in later on in the purport that we're just reading, the embodied soul, by his immemorial desire to avoid Krishna consciousness, causes his own bewilderment. Consequently, although he's constitutionally eternal, blissful, and cognizant due to the littleness of his existence, he forgets his constitutional position of service to the Lord and is thus entrapped by nescience, ignorance. And thus, under the spell of ignorance, the living entity claims that the Lord is responsible for his conditioned existence. That's one of the traps of the mind. That I'm in this situation and it's his fault. After all, I'm innocent, always. I never do anything wrong. Now, what do they call that nowadays? Victimology. When we perceive ourselves as victim all the time and we're always completely innocent. So this is called Maya. It's just like all the people in prison, they're always just saying, I didn't do anything, it's the judge's fault, he put me here. I'm innocent, I didn't do anything. So then Krishna continues, when, however, one is enlightened, so this ignorance is all gone, with the knowledge by which nescience ignorance is destroyed, then his knowledge reveals everything, as the sun lights up everything in the daytime. So as ignorance covers, knowledge illuminates. So one sees properly if one is in the mode of goodness, because sattvam, sanjayate jnanam, that knowledge comes from the mode of goodness. And we all experience this too, that sometimes our perception of reality is completely clouded. You think one thing is happening and it's something else. This is the mode of ignorance. And sometimes we're in one mood and we're perceiving what's going on as one thing, but then we see our mood changes and we see it's not like that at all. So our consciousness causes the clarity or the coveredness of how we perceive reality. Our consciousness governs how accurately we see reality. So when one has knowledge, then one sees properly, and knowledge comes from goodness. Then in the next verse, in 17, one step more than seeing things accurately and getting knowledge. When one's intelligence, mind, faith, and refuge, what a string of things. Intelligence, mind, faith, and refuge are all fixed in the Supreme. When one's intelligence is fixed in the Supreme, one's mind is fixed in the Supreme, one's faith and refuge or shelter are all fixed in the Supreme, then one becomes fully cleansed of misgivings through complete knowledge. So there was knowledge that illumined our life, but this is complete knowledge by fixing, because knowledge came from the mode of goodness, but this, being fixed in the Supreme, is something beyond the mode of goodness. It's completely spiritual. Mind, faith, and refuge are all fixed in the Supreme. Then one becomes fully cleansed of misgivings through complete knowledge and thus proceeds straight on the path of liberation. And then when one is completely fixed in Krishna, what does he see? When one's faith, refuge, mind, intelligence are all fixed on Krishna, on the Supreme, depending upon one's realization of the Supreme, maybe on the Super Soul, Krishna himself, what does one see? So the next verse, text 18, describes that. Famous verse. Vidya vinaya sampane brahmani gavi hastini suni chaiva swapake cha. You know this one? Pandita samadarsana. So he has he sees, not like a vision, but when he looks, when he opens his eyes, this is what he sees. The humble sage, by virtue of true knowledge, that means all his consciousness fixed in the Supreme, sees with equal vision a learned and gentle brahmana, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater. He sees equal vision. He sees accurately their situation. He sees that they are not their body. He sees the bodies and how they act are just manifestations of the modes of material nature, all the things that we've been hearing. He sees like that. And he sees that the soul is completely different. And therefore he's humble. He doesn't take offense. It's just the modes of material nature acting. And not only does he see that the bodies are the person and that the person is eternal, he also sees that Krishna is in everyone's heart. And therefore he's respectful to everyone. The humble sage, by virtue of true knowledge, sees sages by virtue of true knowledge, it's plural. See with equal vision a learned and gentle brahmana, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater. Purport. A Krishna conscious person does not make any distinction between species or caste. Now this is also described in the third canto of the Bhagavatam and the teachings of Kapila Muni. When Kapila Muni describes this, he also makes the point that even though he sees equally, he acts practically. He sees his tiger is a soul in a tiger's body, and an elephant is a soul in an elephant's body, and his friend is a soul in a human body, but he embraces his friend, he doesn't embrace the tiger. He invites the friend over for lunch, but he doesn't invite the elephant over for lunch, or the tiger. So he acts practically. So there's always the theoretical understanding, but then time, place, and circumstance dictate the practical dealings. So Krishna consciousness must always be practical. So a Krishna conscious person does not make any distinction between species or castes. The Brahmin and the outcast may be different from the social point of view, or a dog, a cow, and an elephant may be different from the point of view of species, but these differences of body are meaningless from the viewpoint of learned transcendentalists. This is due to their relationship to the Supreme. For the Supreme Lord, by his plenary portion as Paramatma, is present in everyone's heart. Such an understanding of the Supreme is real knowledge. So there's respect to every living entity. And Kapila Muni describes this, that if you worship Krishna in the form of the deity, but don't respect Krishna in the heart of every living entity, don't so respect people, the people, living entities. That is materialistic bhakti praya. It is like a devotee, but the devotee is respectful to all living entities. Such an understanding of the Supreme is real knowledge. As far as the bodies are concerned, in different castes or different species of life, the Lord is equally kind to everyone because he treats every living being as a friend, yet maintains himself as Paramatma, regardless of the circumstance of the living entities. Like when you think of a friend, one of the things we usually think of is a person will stay with me and in every situation that I'm in. And there's a saying, fair weather friend, that when things are good you have so many friends, but when you're down and things are bad for you, then all your fair weather friends make believe you don't exist. They don't care anymore. They're not friends. But Krishna is not like that. Because regardless of the situation a soul is in, regardless of the body, I mean, he even stays with worms who live in the most foul places. Would you do that? So who's a better friend? Krishna or you? Yes, it's true. He stays with every living entity regardless of their situation, and he awaits for us to turn to him. The Lord as Paramatma is present in the outcast and in the Brahmana, although the body of a Brahmana and that of an outcast are not the same. The bodies are material productions of different modes of material nature, but the soul and the supersoul within the body are of the same spiritual quality. The similarity in the quality of the soul and the supersoul, however, does not make them equal in quantity, for the individual soul is present only in that particular body, whereas the Paramatma is present in each and every body. A Krishna-conscious person has full knowledge of this, and therefore he is truly learned and has equal vision. So equal vision doesn't mean that a person in knowledge sees everyone as one, and there is no difference between anyone. It means that he sees that in everybody there is a soul, and that the super soul, the one super soul, is present in everyone's heart. The similar characteristics of the soul and the super soul are that they are both conscious, eternal, and blissful. But the difference is, so the super, he doesn't equate a person in full knowledge, doesn't equate the soul with the super soul. But the difference is between the soul and the super soul is that the individual soul is conscious within the limited jurisdiction of the body, whereas the super soul is conscious of all bodies. The super soul is present in all bodies without distinction. Okay, I'll stop here. Any questions or comments? Yes.
You know, like in the previous word it says that it is because the desire of the living entity is suffering. Like in the action and the reaction, I mean the action are made by the modes of material nature, circumstances and things like that, but it is our desire to lord it over the material nature.
And specific desires as well.
Yeah. And
desires cause our situation and then we get the reactions.
Yeah. And so then where does the desire started from, like?
Originally.
Yeah, but we are like over here for so many births. So it's very hard to find that out.
Yeah.
Where the desire starts from.
But what Krishna says in the 15th chapter is don't try to intellectually figure out where it starts from. Just cut your attachment to it now. To the tree of the material world. With the sword of knowledge, speaks in the same way. With the sword of knowledge, cut your attachment to the material world. Because if you try, it's like a big bunion tree. You can't tell where it begins, you can't tell where it ends, and we're jumping from branch to branch based on our desires. And if we leave this world, we're dying and we think of all the things that we wanted that we didn't get and the frustrations and old age and if only I could have done this. And actually the studies have studied the mentality of old people and they asked them, what's your greatest regret? And almost invariably it's, I should have done something. I wanted to do it and I should have done it. Not that I made a mistake, I did something I shouldn't have done it, but it's usually I had the chance to do something and I didn't do it. So if that's filling one's mind, oh, I should have done this, then when one's leaving this world, oh, only if this would have happened, then that will dictate our next birth. And everyone is filled with all the frustrations that we have gathered in life from all the things that we wanted to do and didn't do and all the things that we wish would have happened that didn't happen, all the things that we wish didn't happen that did happen. We're filled with these things, all the wounds and scars of growing up in the material world. You know, my parents weren't the right kind of parents, or my sisters and brothers weren't the right kind of sisters or brothers. And I didn't have the you know what some of my friends had, and I had curly hair and they had straight hair, and now I have no hair, and one of my friends, he could really run, and another one could really sing, and I never could do that. So we become filled with all these things, these frustrations, and it's frustrating like when we're young. And then it's also frustrating when you're old, in the middle of you striving. But at the end of your life, you end up being very frustrated by all the things you missed out on. And because then you start looking at all the people who have the things that you don't have and didn't have. And you start lamenting, oh, if only I could be doing that again and things like that. And we're really planting the seeds for our next birth in that way. So in that sense, our material situation is simply based on our desires. So what Krishna recommends is not to go and find out what was the original desire that caused me, because it's very hard to find that out, but we can know in a general way there is some enmity with Krishna. I don't want to accept my position or relationship with him, but what he recommends is... Huh? Four? Yes. In text 3 and 4. The real form of this tree of the material world cannot be perceived in this world. no one can understand where it ends, where it begins, or where its foundation is. Like a huge, complicated banyan tree. Do they have those in Kenya? Well, you can see one. They have something like them in Perth, but they have them in India. In Philippines they have? Yeah? In Singapore they have? You know, those trees that have the roots turn into trunks and then they branch out and more and you can't tell where the beginning is. In Hong Kong they have them. So the real form, you can't tell where it begins, where it ends, or where its foundation is. But with determination, one must cut down this strongly rooted tree with the weapon of detachment. No, I don't want... detachment coming from knowledge, that I don't want what this world has to give. There's no situation in the material world that will actually satisfy me and make me happy. Therefore, one must seek that place from which, having gone, one never returns, and there surrender to that Supreme Personality of Godhead, from whom everything began and from whom everything has extended since time immemorial. Cut down the strongly rooted tree with a weapon of detachment. So that's the recommendation of Krishna there. So what was it? Did that answer your question? The question of what was the original desire? Here's a question though. What happens if you say, yeah, this is correct, but I'm not quite on that level? Then what do I do?
Krishna said in the third chapter that I have the person who is sincere will go on the path.
Have any suggestions while we're finding this one?
Yeah, on the other end, if a sincere person tries to control active senses, their mind, and begin karma yoga in Krishna conscious without attachment, he is far by superior. So we should start.
And we should know what the philosophy is, we should know what the ideal is. And we shouldn't be, Prabhupada explains this in the Bhagavad Gita, we shouldn't be envious of our own lack of ability. We shouldn't be try to change the philosophy and the truth because we don't have the capacity. We're not on that level. We should be humble and try our best to move in that way. So some people are very advanced and they can move straight due to the depth of their realizations. Some people less advanced have to go like that. Some people go like that, some people go like that, but we shouldn't go like that. We should know what the goal is and move in that direction, which is basically what you're saying. Practice karma yoga, just do something to move forward, but see things accurately through the eyes of Shastra.
So you understand that desire is very crucial and Krishna consciousness means to gradually cultivate a depth of desire different from the desires that got us into this situation. But the situation with the body, the mind, the conditioning, the personality, it's all remains. So it's very difficult actually because intention may be there, right?
Well, then get the intention.
Yeah.
We try to make the intention right.
Yeah.
So whatever situation we're in, we should try our best. We should get our intention right, and we should do the things that increase our proper desiring and minimize or avoid the things that increase our improper desiring. So therefore, Like if you want to stop drinking liquor, so don't spend your time in the bars, the pubs. Rather, you should spend your time with the devotees, and hear shastra that will increase good desires and minimize the improper. We're already, as you're saying, we're already, because we're in the material world, in particular minds and bodies, and we have our different karma. We all have to struggle with that, our conditioning. So wherever we are, we should place ourselves in a good situation, so that good intentions will be increased, and our bad intentions, negative, materialistic, selfish, petty, mean, desires will be minimized a lot by association and hearing what you hear about. If you hear about, remember we did that, we talked about Hawaii one day? Especially when the weather's like this in Perth, when it's really cold or something, start talking about Hawaii and we all want to go. Because what you hear about, the desires to increase to go to that place if it's a good place. So let's hear about Krishna, let's hear about Goloka Vrindavan, let's hear about Krishna's wonderful pastimes, his activities, his way of dealing, chant his holy names, and improve our desires. And actually, if your desires are good, then your activities improve too. Because we tend to do what we desire, what we want, what we desire. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Any other? Yeah.
How do we get this samadarshana?
Well, it's said. What is the verse right before it? Read it out loud.
Then one's intelligence, mind, faith, and refuge are all fixed in the Supreme. Then one becomes fully cleansed of misgivings through complete knowledge, and thus proceeds straight on the path of liberation.
Yeah. So then the next question is, well, how do you fix your mind, intelligence, faith, and refuge in the Supreme? Well, that's our whole process. We chant Hare Krishna. Here, Shastra, we serve as best we can. That's our process, associate with devotees. We look at the beautiful forms of the deities. And we allow our minds to be captivated by the incredible desire to have a relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the more our consciousness is fixed, intelligence, mind, refuge, and
faith.
It's a nice analysis. What's the Sanskrit?
Tad buddhayas.
Intelligence.
Tad atmana.
Yeah.
Tan nishtash.
Faith.
Tat parayana.
Parayana. What is that? What is the translation, huh?
The word for the translation. Who have completely taken shelter of him.
Mm. When you were in the water, each of you water, where did you take shelter? Did you find a shelter? What did you do? Of course, it's hard to remember. You just tried your best. You took shelter of your own ability. What did you take shelter of?
Bubbles.
Nothing. What did you take shelter of? You were little.
Knowledge.
Huh?
Knowledge.
Knowledge, your own abilities. What did you take shelter of?
Mm-hmm.
cried, help, help, so I could settle with everyone.
Anyone who helped me? That's that old joke. What did you take shelter of?
I was trying to hold
some. Yeah, yourself. But so sometimes we can pull ourselves out by our own abilities, but there will come a time in life where all the things that we have relied on in our life will let us down. Our strength, our intelligence, everything fails us. I once had an experience in Vrindavan. I had bought a motor scooter, but it was actually it was heavier than I had the ability to control easily. And they had a speed bump on the road. I was coming back from Govardhan, and there was like a speed bump on the road, and I decided to go around it. And I was going around it, and it started falling out of control. It started moving, started going too far to the side, and I wasn't very expert in it. And everything sort of seemed to slow down. Do you know how to ride a scooter? Of course. From Gandhi boy from Delhi, you must know. But anyway, so I started going over, and everything sort of went into slow motion. And I started thinking, philosophizing, I started thinking, this is just like death. And I tried to do everything I could to move it back, and it was still kept on going. And I thought, this is just like death, that you try all your tricks. Because, you know, you get sick, and we're all used to getting better when we get sick. But there's going to be some point where we get sick and then just keep on going down and down. And then at one point, I realized this is out of control, and I'm going down. And I was sort of watching it happen, too, at the same time. And I fell, and the bike and the scooter went into, it was on the embankment, and it fell into a whole tangle of bauble bushes. Bauble means sticker bushes. And there I was, and I couldn't move. I couldn't move because it was stickers, and I was the thing was, and I'm still there. I couldn't get out. I stayed there. So, but you might ask, how did I get out? Because I'm not there now. And then immediately, as soon as I fell over, a temple, a Vrindavan special three-wheel vehicle came by, and these Brijbasis, all these Brijbasi men, they just immediately jumped out, and they picked me up. And set me back up, and then they went on. that's like a Vrindavan special. You know, Krishna sees you, and you know you're not out of his sight in Vrindavan like that. But I couldn't move. The bike was on top, and every movement, because I was all in the sticker bushes, and I couldn't move. So I was protected by Krishna. But that's what's going to happen to everyone. At some point, that all the things that we use, usually to straighten ourselves up, to get us out of the water, they're going to fail. So where will our refuge be? So we want to practice in life, making our refuge, calling out to Krishna to help us. So it's an interesting way to look at all the difficulties of life. We look at them as the difficulties as bad. Because no one wants difficulties. But instead of looking at them as bad, watch where your mind goes to shelter. And so it's like Krishna holding up a mirror and letting you see where you look for your shelter when times are difficult. And then when you get the results of your examination, you can decide what you have to improve and what you have to study more of, or maybe you pass. I remember there was many years ago, there was this one young boy named Birbhadra. He was just young, and Prabhupada was in Los Angeles. Might have been the time when was Birbhadra there when you were there? Mm-hmm. And Shilavati's son?
No, he's not.
Okay. But he got hit by a car. And when Prabhupada heard that when he got hit by the car, not super seriously, he got knocked off his bicycle, I think, yes, he got knocked off his bicycle. Prabhupada heard that he chanted as soon as he got hit. Prabhupada said, oh, that means he's liberated. Because his refuge, faith, mind, intel, everything was fixed in the Supreme by the grace of Krishna.
Did he become unliberated again?
Yeah, he became unliberated. Mm-hmm. And I asked Prabhupada that question, not based on that, but how could you become liberated at one point and become unliberated? Mm-hmm. And he said the intoxication of Maya is very strong. It's easy to become intoxicated unless one is fixed in the Supreme, fixed in the Self.